From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Denis Tanovich about making a war movie that is about the absurdities of war. The movie No Man's Land won the Best Screenplay Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It's set in the Bosnian War. Tanovich saw much of the war through the lens of a camera. He was the Bosnian Army's cameraman, collecting images for the Bosnian archive. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg talks about robot voices, both in the movies and in real life, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Artie Shaw box set. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Frank Stachow. The CIA confirmed today that one of its covert operatives was killed during a prison uprising at a fortress near Mazar-e Sharif. Johnny Spann is the first known American combat death in Afghanistan. Spann's body was recovered today. One of the five American soldiers wounded by friendly fire in Afghanistan is reported to be in serious condition. The other four are listed in good condition. The Pentagon says they were hit Monday when a so-called smart bomb missed its target. The team had called in airstrikes on a fort where the Taliban prison uprising was underway. Taliban leader Mullah Mohammed Omar reportedly survived last night's attack on suspected Taliban command center, and NPR Scott Horsley reports.
The Reuters news service quotes Omar giving a radio address to his followers in which he orders the Taliban to stand and fight. Pentagon officials say they'd hoped Omar would be in the leadership compound when it was destroyed by U.S. bombs. Rear Admiral John Stuffelbeam says the attack was part of a growing effort to target Taliban and al-Qaeda leaders.
The pressure has been stepped up, and there are fewer Taliban and al-Qaeda forces that are resisting than there were days ago.
U.S. warplanes are also dropping leaflets in parts of Afghanistan, encouraging Taliban soldiers to defect. Stuffelbeam says interviews with some defectors suggest those leaflets are working. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
U.S. Envoy Anthony Zinni met with Palestinian leaders today and called for an end to the violence that has stymied progress on peace talks for the past 14 months. Zinni met with Palestinian Authority President Yasser Arafat and toured the West Bank. NPR's Peter Kenyon reports.
After a day of seeing and hearing Israel's security grievances against Palestinian militants, complaints underscored by the shooting deaths of three Israelis, Zinni got a close-up look at the daily hardship facing Palestinians and at the expansion of Israeli settlements since the Oslo Agreement was crafted. Zinni raised the issue of settlements with Israeli officials yesterday, but he also stressed that violence must come to an end if there's to be any progress. He repeated that theme today, saying both sides have suffered enough and it's time for a change. Arafat said he was exerting 100% effort to stop the violence from Palestinian militants. Israeli and U.S. officials dispute that, saying the burden is on the Palestinian leader to crack down on the killings before there can be any movement toward peace. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Dynergy today called off its planned $9 billion acquisition of the energy corporation Enron. Both companies are based in Houston. Enron's stock fell 85% and closed at 61 cents today on the New York Stock Exchange. The merger was called off after two agencies downgraded Enron's credit rating to junk status. On Wall Street today, the Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 160 points to close at 97.11. The S&P 500 was down almost 21 and the Nasdaq fell 48. You're listening to NPR News. The remains of all but one of the passengers and crew on the doomed United Flight 93, which crashed September 11th in rural Pennsylvania, have been identified. Mark Neutbauer of member station WDUQ has the story.
The identification of human remains gathered from the field near Shanksville, Pennsylvania, began soon after the terrorist attacks of September 11th. Fingerprints and dental records were used to make some identifications, but DNA technology has been used in most cases. Somerset County Coroner Wallace Miller says he is confident the 40th passenger will be identified. Miller says work at the Armed Forces DNA lab in Rockville, Maryland, will not stop once that final identification is made. All of the remains recovered from the crash site will be analyzed. That work is expected to take until the end of February. All 44 people on board, including four terrorists, died when the plane crashed. Crews continued to gather debris from the abandoned strip mine where the plane went down. More material was found in trees after the leaves had fallen. Topsoil will be brought in next week to cover the impact crater. For NPR News, I'm Mark Neutbar in Pittsburgh.
President Bush says the government's doing all it can to speed up the process of screening airline baggage for the holiday season. The president says he hopes to post National Guard troops at security checkpoints and have airplanes full of air marshals during the holidays. But Transportation Secretary Norman Mineta said yesterday the government probably will not meet the 60-day deadline for all airline baggage to be screened. He says there are too few employees, bomb-sniffing dogs, and explosive detection machines. A snowstorm in the southern plains today caused icy roads and traffic tie-ups throughout the region. The storm dropped as much as 9 inches of snow in some parts of Texas. It was blamed for hundreds of traffic accidents and many school closures. I'm Frank Stachow in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Merrill Lynch, offering customized wealth management services for qualified investors. 1-800-MERRILL or www.askmerrill.ml.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Denis Tanovich, has written and directed a war movie that he describes as his vote against violence of any kind. The movie, No Man's Land, won the Best Screenplay Award at the Cannes Film Festival. It's set in 1993 during the Bosnian War. A Serb soldier and a Bosnian soldier are trapped in a trench between enemy lines. A second Bosnian soldier, who was presumed to be dead, regains consciousness to find he's lying on a spring mine that will explode if he moves. So the three soldiers' lives depend on working together to prevent this mine from exploding. Filmmaker Denis Tanovich was a student studying film and theater in Sarajevo when the war broke out. He volunteered for the army, but ended up carrying a camera instead of a gun, documenting the war for the Bosnian archive. I asked Tanovich how his experiences with UN peacekeepers during the war influenced how he portrayed them in his movie.
If you look well in my film, you will see that United Nations soldiers, well, they are almost the only positive characters in the film, because that's how I felt about them. The problem was not those soldiers, the problem was here in United States, in New York, with United Nations politics, in fact, with their desire to do nothing, hiding behind neutrality. And, you know, I don't believe in neutrality because I don't think it exists. Simple as that.
In one of the early scenes in your movie, a wounded soldier takes a pretty big risk to get a cigarette butt to smoke, only to realize he doesn't have a match. Do you smoke?
Yeah, I do.
Was it hard for you during the war to find cigarettes?
Well, you know, I think the two most important things during the war were cigarette and coffee. And if we wouldn't have those ones, then, you know, life would be very difficult. But fortunately, we somehow managed always to find something, yeah. Well, I will not tell you about the quality. It was definitely not any great brand of cigarette, but, you know, it was, well, we made with what we had.
What's the biggest risk you took for a cigarette?
You know, I wouldn't miss a day in a unit when they were giving those. So, you know, in just being a survivor is risking your life every day. So going to take a pack of cigarettes, you know, running for 1 kilometer from home to frontline just to pick up, well, you know, it's dangerous enough.
The main feeling in your movie is that the war is somewhat ridiculous. The soldiers don't really want to kill each other, and they certainly don't want to die. And you imagine them always asking themselves, what are we doing here? Is that the feeling you had during the war?
Well, I think that's the feeling you get after some point you get in any war. You know, when war goes on, the reasons just get lost. And that's, you know, war is an absurd. We're killing each other for this reason or that reason. But finally, you know, I don't think any reason is good enough to kill each other.
You were a student in Sarajevo when the war broke out in 92. How did you end up in the Bosnian army?
Well, you know, in the beginning, it was not Bosnian army. You have to understand that when Bosnia was recognized in 1992, the only real army which existed was Yugoslav army. And then as Bosnia separated from Yugoslavia, this army just went into hands of Serbs, of what rest over Yugoslavia. So when they started to bomb Sarajevo, I just went to the police station and asked, what can I do? And, you know, they told me, well, you can go with these four guys. And we were five guys with one machine gun walking down the street and pretending to be whatever, special force. And after a few days, I just realized that nobody's filming what's happening. So I took camera and I started filming, and that's how I stayed. You know, next 2 years I spent in front lines of Sarajevo filming what's going on and filming life in Sarajevo.
Now, were you shooting film in any official capacity? In other words, were you just doing it as an individual, or were you like the official cameraman for the Bosnian army?
Yeah, I was working for the army. I was a soldier. But in the beginning, there was no army, so, you know, the army was made up a few months later, you know. So I was in the same place, but suddenly we were called the Bosnian Army. So, yes, I was working for the army, for a film archive of Bosnian Army.
Did you carry a gun?
In the beginning, yes, but, you know, as we didn't have too many guns, I gave mine to a friend who was in front line all the time and couldn't defend himself, and I just kept hand grenade for me. In a case they would capture me, because I didn't want to go into hands of our dear enemies.
So you were prepared to blow yourself up?
Well, if I felt it in hands, yes. I preferred to kill myself than to let them the pleasure of killing me.
Did you ever come close to thinking you were going to need it?
Well, I never thought I'm going to die, frankly. You know, I don't know. I was young. I was 23 years old. I was crazy, and I never thought of death. I just hoped that I will not get blown, you know, to stay without leg or whatever, to be mutilated. But death, you know, after sometimes you don't even think about it. It's all around you, so you just live your life.
Did the camera give you any feelings of safety? Did you feel at all protected by being behind
it's
a camera?
It's a very good question. It's a strange feeling that I had. I had a feeling that camera protected me in a certain way, you know, because when you're working on the front line, well, you know, you don't have time to feel fear, or you don't shoot anything. So you expose yourself even more than you should do normally because you're filming. But then again, you have somehow feeling that you are not there, that all this stuff is happening, you know, in the film, because you're watching everything through the camera. So I think camera helped me a lot, and I don't know, maybe we should do some psychoanalyzing here, but I don't think we have time for that. But it definitely helped me out, because I was occupied, you know, my mind was occupied all the time. Although I had time to think, I never had time to become desperate then, because there was always something to do, something to film, you know. So for 2 years I was every day filming.
You know what I'm thinking? When you're in the middle of battle, you're so out of control. But if you're behind the camera, you're at least controlling the framing of the war.
That's true. That's true. It's putting some order in the mess.
Right. Are there risks that you think you took to get good footage that you might not have taken just as a soldier?
Well, I repeat you. You know, it's very. I don't think it's understandable for you. What happened in Sarajevo. I mean, just being in Sarajevo is dangerous enough. Yesterday I had a talk with a correspondent, American correspondent, who was in all the war around the world, and he told me the thing that really bothered me about Bosnia is that you couldn't run away, because normally there are front lines, so you can run. If they shoot, you can run back, but in Bosnia there was no back. Everything was front, so, you know, you would just duck, and that's it, and hope that you stay alive.
Are there things that you witnessed through the camera that you might not otherwise have watched?
Frankly, a lot of them. With a camera, I had a chance to see things that most, even soldier, couldn't see, because I was there when everything, when something was happening, you know, because when there's nothing happening, when there's nothing to film. So they would invite me each time there was something happening. So I had a chance, you know, to film from mass graves to fights to war criminals and you know, all kind of stuff. Well, you maybe even don't want to see.
Tell us about one of the things that you might otherwise not have wanted to see, but you felt committed to see because you were documenting it.
I don't know, you know, I can't, frankly, all of it. I just can't take one thing, you know. War is a place, and war is something you really don't want to see anything of it. You don't want to see destruction of your city. You don't want to see destruction of your life, your friends being killed, or people that you don't know being blown to pieces, or people getting killed by snipers just because they went to pick some water. You know, I didn't want to see any of it.
Did you have any standards about what was too gruesome to film, or did you just film whatever you saw so that there would be some documentation of it? I mean, for example, if you're filming something for network news in the United States, there are certain scenes that you know they won't put on TV because it's too gruesome. But you were doing this for more archival purposes.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't have this kind of... I was filming everything I think I should film. And, of course, there's always auto-censure, how do you say it? You know, you are...
Self-censorship?
Yeah, self-censorship, because you just need, you know, you just have it in yourself. And there are sometimes things that you just don't want to do to film. And sometimes I would even leave camera because, you know, there would be wounded people, so they need to be taken into hospital, and I can't film them. If I film them, they're going to die, maybe, you see? So you can't...
What choice would you make in a situation like that?
I would always stop filming.
Stop filming and take them to the hospital?
Well, definitely. You know, in you have to make choices in life, and I think our job, well, filming and even journalism... has a lot to do with ethic. You know, if you're not ethical, then you can't do your job. And I don't consider my job as a business. What I do, I don't consider it as, you know, as a business. So it, for me, it would be deeply immoral to film people who are dying and knowing that I could maybe help them and bring them to hospital. So, but then again, each person has his choices. That was mine. I also, you know, during the war, I was making footage which I was giving to all the journalists around the world. The chosen one, of course, because we couldn't show front lines to the journalists, because then Serbs might see that we have three guns for 300 meters of front line, because we didn't have any weapon, as you know. So this kind of footage I wouldn't give. But all the rest I was giving, and I was giving for free with my friends, because why for free? Because first of all, we would think it would be immoral to make money over our buddies who are defending city, you know. So we couldn't sell it. And then we had this, you know, you hang on crazy things in this kind of situation. I was thinking, if I sell one footage, then I'm going to die filming next one. So it was kind of protection for me, you know. And I just kept filming thinking that nothing bad can happen to me, and nothing bad happened to me. I know it's crazy belief, but still you get to believe in something. So
I imagine that is true, that you have to believe in something.
You do, and I believed in my friends and in myself. That's all.
And did you feel like your friends believed in you?
Well, they had to, you know, because when you're in this kind of situation, you have to hang on your pals, you know. If you think that they're going to leave you in the bad situation, then you would feel really bad. But if you know that, you know, even if you die, they're going to bring your body down to city and, you know, bury you as you should be buried, then it's a different feeling. So, yes, it's very important to have good friends. And I think only people who survive this kind of situation can understand which kind of friendship you have in this kind of situation.
Are you still close with some of the people who you traveled with during the war?
Yes, very much. And I think we're going to stay like that forever. Even if we don't see each other, you know, we just, there is something between us. There is a code between us.
My guest is Denis Tanović. His new film, No Man's Land, is set during the Bosnian War. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Denis Tanović, and his new movie is called No Man's Land. It's about the war in Bosnia. During the war, he was a cameraman for the Bosnian army. How was the footage that you shot during the war used, in addition to being archived?
Well, you know, a lot of people used it. You know, I think some things even you saw even on maybe in CNN or BBC, a lot of footage was used in a film that are being done about the Bosnian War. A lot of footage was used by United Nations Commission for Investigation of War Crimes. So there are different things, you know. It's footage that's being used for all different kind of things.
Are there have you ever like had the TV on and suddenly there's war footage that you've shot?
Yeah, I saw it a few times. Yeah, of course.
What impact does it have on you to kind of relive the war through footage that you shot yourself?
Mm. Well, you know, funny thing is when I look now, things that I've been filming, I feel sick. And I wonder how could I do that? And I don't know. It's a strange feeling. I see sometimes crazy things I was doing, like running in front of people who are shooting, you know, to film them shooting and stuff like that. And you say, how could I do this? Or just going into mass grave and filming that. And, you know, I feel rather sick when I see it today. And at that moment, I was not. I was just doing what I thought was right to do. So, you know, I don't know if I would do the same thing today. I like to believe that I would, but, you know, I'm not sure.
Are there any scenes that you actually shot on camera from the war that you tried to recreate in your new movie, No Man's Land?
Well, there's a lot of situations that I've been, not that I filmed. Yes, some of them, like shooting and stuff like that. But there's a lot of things that I actually lived. Like this, I'm sure you laughed about the guy who comes in the middle of all this and says, "What a mess in Rwanda."
Yeah. Let me explain. You know, they're like in a trench and there's, you know, firing all around. And one of the guys is reading the newspaper, I guess, and he says, what a mess it is in Rwanda.
Well, and this thing happened actually to me because we were on front line. It was early morning and there is one of our friends coming on front line and he's all white. And he sits and said, "Oh, my God." And we were looking at him, and we thought, like, his father died because it was night of shelling, and it was a mess. And we were like, "Are you okay? Is everything?" And said, "Oh, my God, what? And we, you know, we all came around him, like, "Are you okay? What happened? Calm down. You want some water? You want a cigarette?" And then after you know, a few moments, he said, "What a mess in Rwanda." And we look at him and said, "Do you know where you are, for God's sake? What's wrong with you?" You know? And, you know, I just put it in my film because it, you know, it sounded right because it is crazy situation. And the sentence, "What a mess in Rwanda," in any other situation would be, you know, would have total different meaning, would have meaning it should have, but not in that situation.
You got out of Sarajevo in 1994. How did you get out?
Well, I get out in a jeep of a British fighter pilot. I was hidden in behind of his jeep. He was a friend of a friend, and he came suddenly one day with a jeep, and he said, "You know, you have 15 minutes, pick up your stuff, and we out." So that's how I left.
How did you feel about leaving, and leaving behind other people in the army who were fighting the war, leaving behind the work that you were doing, shooting the war?
Well, in 1994, in Sarajevo situation, you remember there was a big massacre in Sarajevo. I don't know if you remember. And after that, Serbs just moved away. And we frankly thought that war was going to finish because we thought, you know, NATO gave the ultimatum to Serbs that they have to move away. And everything seemed that as if war is going to finally be over because we believed in intervention and Serbs pulled out. And situation got better for Sarajevo. Food started to come in and, you know, situation just got better. And unfortunately, 1 year later, well, eight months later, they started to shell again. So, and then again, when I left Sarajevo, I didn't know that I'm going to leave, you know, forever. I wanted to leave for 2 weeks just to get some rest because you can't imagine which kind of shape you are after 2 years of war. And I was for 2 years in war. I was one of the first volunteers in Bosnian War. And of the guys from my unit in the beginning of war. We were 25. I think we had two who stayed alive finally. And, you know, I just felt tired, and I had a girlfriend who was outside, and I desperately wanted to be with her at that time and to get some rest. And when I got finally to Belgium, well, the situation was looking better. Even the tram started to work in Sarajevo. And, you know, they proposed me to stay in Film Academy in Belgium, and that's what I did. You know, you don't always make plans when you do this kind of things. Things just happen in life, sometimes without you planning them. So when they proposed me to stay in Academy, situation was okay in Sarajevo. I accepted, and I started studying. And I was always, for next, you know, when war restarted in Bosnia, I was always on the point to leave if anything would go wrong with Sarajevo, you know, with the front lines around Sarajevo. But, you know, until the end of war, Serbs didn't move any line around.
Tell me more about the shape you were in after 2 years of war.
Well, I think I was 65 kilos, and, well, you should see me. I don't think you can't compare things, but we looked very much like people getting out of concentration camps. Not in that desperate situation, and I don't like comparing things, you know, because it would be comparing apples and oranges. But those images that you remember so well from people going out of concentration camps in Second World War were images you could see in Bosnia all around.
Your film shows that you have, you know, a real keen sense of irony and, you know, a sense of humor. Mm. Was there any sense of irony or sense of humor left after 2 years of war?
Yes. You know, Bosnians are very known for their black humor. And, I'm sure you laughed during the film. And a lot of those things really happened in the war. You know, for us, humor was a way to survive, was our biggest defense mechanism, was our weapon somehow. And I like to compare our humor somehow to a Jewish humor, which is, I think, somewhere sane, which came out of all this troubles that the Jewish people lived through. And Bosnians, in that sense, well, have thousands of years of war behind them, because all the time somebody's trying to attack and to take a piece of land, and, you know. And I thought, like, okay, as it was there in war, why not to put it in the film? So we are very known, if you want, in the region as people who laugh about almost everything, because you can't laugh about everything, but you can laugh about a lot of things. And I think the big strength of Bosnian is that they laugh about themselves too, which gives them right to laugh about the others. Because it's very important, I think, to have this balance and to be able to laugh about yourself.
Denis Tanović wrote and directed the new movie No Man's Land. It opens in New York and L.A. December 7th and in more cities the following week. Tanović will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, from the National Endowment for the Arts, and Delacorte Press, a division of Random House, publisher of The Fiery Cross, a novel by Diana Gabaldon, author of The Outlander Saga. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Artie Shaw box set. Linguist Jeff Nunberg compares robot and computer voices to the real thing, and we continue our discussion with Bosnian filmmaker Denis Tanović. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Donis Tanović. He wrote and directed the new film No Man's Land, which is set in the Bosnian War. Tanović was in the Bosnian army during the war, working as the army's cameraman, documenting the war for the Bosnian archive. After the war, I guess while you were living in Belgium, you made two documentaries about the war. What were the subjects of the documentaries?
Well, I just told you a few minutes ago, if you remember, that the war stays after the actual war is finished. And one night I was calling a friend of mine, and his wife answered the phone. I was in Brussels, and she told me, you know, he left for Bosnia. And I said, why? Well, what do you mean he left for Bosnia? Because it was just the end of the war. And she said to me, well, remember this wounded guy who is living in a little village next to Brussels? Well, he left to bring his family. And this guy that she was talking about is a guy who got blown by a mine. So he stayed without hands and without eyes. And he was living in total dark. And he was evacuated from Gorazde enclave in 1994. And he was living for 2 years in dark, waiting for his family to come. And I just couldn't sleep that night. And early morning, I went to a production house and I said, listen, I need two cameras. And it was a school, in fact, production house and a school of documentary films, in which I gave some lectures. And, you know, they just gave me everything I asked. And I went there and I put one camera on the border waiting for family, and I put another one in his room, filming as he waiting. And, you know, I just asked him to tell his story. And it was 13-minute film, which was awarded on a lot of festivals around the world. So it was just an idea I had in the evening, and you know, the power of this film is in its simplicity and in universality, because each one of us had at one time or another somebody that we lost or lose or that we were waiting. So he was waiting his wife and his children, and he said, you know, my wife's going to be my eyes and my kid's going to be my hands. And in the final moment of the film, when they came into the room, when they entered and when they started kissing each other, well, you know, that's the moment where, as we say in my country, even the stone would cry. And I just wanted to show to people that war is not only about shooting, it's state of mind. And it stays a long time after it's actually finished. And I think, frankly, it stays forever. I don't think we'll ever get rid of these ghosts who stays in us. So that was one. That was the first film, which was called The Dawn. Second film I made was a film about Bosnia reconstruction and people wanting to go back. And that was the moment when, in fact, I finally saw what my country was after the war. And I met my country for the first time, in fact. It was a really beautiful experience because I was going from north to south and from east to west, filming people who are trying to, well, rebuild their lives. And it was in the same sense, film about war, about what stays after.
Where do you live now?
I live in Paris.
How come you decided not to return to Sarajevo to live?
Well, you know, I just came back from Sarajevo. Before coming in States, I was in Sarajevo for a few days. I go every 2-3 months. I have my parents who live there, and I have some friends living there still. And people are coming back, although the situation is rather desperate in Bosnia today. But, you know, as I think there's the answer, because the situation is desperate. And to think that I'm going to be able to make movies, and, you know, making movies is an expensive toy. And to make movies in Bosnia, it's even ridiculous to think in that terms, because there are people starving really to death in Bosnia today. There are old people who just don't have anything to eat anymore because, you know, the system was broke down and nothing is being reconstructed. And, you know, just in, like in my film, the world made image of Bosnia, and which we have today, is like everything is okay in Bosnia now and everything is fine, but nothing is fine in Bosnia. There are war criminals still walking free around Sarajevo. There are people who actually shoot in Sarajevo. And because of the total amnesty They're just walking free around Sarajevo, going back into their apartments and taking out from those apartments, for example, refugees from Srebrenica. And those people can't go back to Srebrenica because Srebrenica is still under Serbian power. So you have a situation in which Bosnians are paying again the highest price of being Democrats. And the situation is rather desperate. And all of this is happening because, well, with Dayton Agreement, the victims and the aggressors were equalized. You know, we are all equal now. And I don't know. It's rather desperate.
What are your parents' lives like now?
Difficult. Life is difficult there, I'm telling you. You know, it's... I don't know if I can, if you can understand, but it's like if, well, not maybe Osama bin Laden walking in New York, but it's like if the people who are helping him in doing that were still walking free around, and you would know them, and you can't do anything about it. You know,
are your parents?
Some of them can't be stopped because there are not enough proofs, and some of those can't be stopped because they are still hiding. And, you know, my parents, my mother is a teacher of music who retired 2-3 years ago, so she spent most of her time home. My father is still working in a Bosnian television. He's chief editor, so he works there. Well, but
are your parents still living in the home they lived in before the war, or was that home destroyed?
Yes. Our apartment, thank God, was okay. We just had a few bullets passing through and a few shrapnels here and there, but, you know, for example, the apartment above us was blown to pieces, an apartment next to us was blown to pieces. But, you know, there are no rules. So we got lucky.
Denis Tanović is my guest, and his new movie, No Man's Land, is set in the war in Bosnia. During the war, he was a cameraman for the Bosnian army, documenting the war on film. Your film was screened at the Toronto Film Festival on September 9th, 2 days before the attacks. What went through your mind on the 11th? Were you still in Toronto then?
No, I was in the airplane when it happened. I was in the airplane flying from Paris to Bordeaux. And, I think we all felt the same thing. And it was my producer who called me on the phone and told me what happened. And I couldn't believe. I couldn't believe. Simple, you know. Same thing, like I couldn't believe that siege of Sarajevo is possible. And so I think I had the same feeling. And of the, you know, rather desperate feeling.
Did it reactivate then, the feelings of insecurity and that anything can happen, feelings that you had during the war?
No, I don't have feeling of insecurity. You know, I think once you live through war, you're just happy for any other day you live on this earth, and you're happy about it. So I don't have feeling of insecurity. I can't live like that. I still fly the airplanes. I still live my life. And I think that's the only way that we should all behave, because anything else would be defeat.
You said that by the end of the second year of the war in Bosnia, when you got out, that you nearly looked like the survivor of a concentration camp. You'd lost so much weight. Did your body return to what it was before the war, or was it permanently changed by what you'd been through?
No, I was young at the time. I was 23, and when I got out of the war, I was 25, and it's still young. My parents never recovered from that. My parents, you can see that they lived through something hard. I still feel some things, like I can't sleep in a cold room anymore, because you have to understand that in Sarajevo, it didn't have any heat, for example, and there is minus 25 degrees Celsius in the evening sometimes, and it's like you're sleeping outside in the field in the winter. And even worse, because there is wind. And since then, I can't stand sleeping in a cold, because I got ill immediately after. If I sleep in a cold room, tomorrow I'm ill. So that's one thing, but it's not very big deal, I guess. There are people who have much, much bigger scars.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I wish you the best with your new movie. Thank you.
Thank you.
Denis Tanović wrote and directed the new film No Man's Land. It opens in New York and L.A. December 7th, and in more cities the following week. Arranger and composer Ralph Burns died last week at the age of 79 of pneumonia and complications of a stroke. He'd worked with the Woody Herman Band, Tony Bennett, Ray Charles, and Peggy Lee, and he orchestrated movie scores and Broadway musicals. We're going to hear his composition, Early Autumn, which was written and arranged for the Woody Herman Band. Here's their 1976 concert version with Stan Getz on tenor and Ralph Burns at the piano. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg compares computer voices and human voices. This is Fresh Air. For 50 years, movies have been imagining how talking robots and computers would sound. But when machines actually started to talk, their voices were like nothing we'd ever heard. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg thinks that's because we have trouble imagining how truly unhuman machines really are.
According to a legend, the first talking machine was invented by Roger Bacon, the 12th century scientist and polymath that the medievals called Dr. Mirabilis. After 7 years' labor, Bacon fashioned a brazen head to hold philosophical discourses with. According to an Elizabethan version of the story, the head was awakened one day by Bacon's inept servant. "Time is," it said. When the servant asked what it meant, the head responded, "Time was." The servant became vexed and insisted that the head explain itself. "Time is past," it said, at which point a hand with a hammer appeared and broke it into 1,000 pieces. The story doesn't say anything about what sort of voice the brazen head had. Brassy, I'd imagine. It wasn't until the advent of talking pictures that people began to give machines voices of their own. There's a curious catch-22 to that exercise. The point is to convey the machine's singular lack of humanity, but the only way to do that is by giving it a voice that connotes some uniquely human deficiency of personality. The progenitor of the breed was Robbie the Robot, who stole the show in the 1956 sci-fi classic Forbidden Planet. Robbie was the cinema's first lovable robot. He looked like a metallic Michelin man and spoke in a ponderous monotone like a butler who was trapped inside a garbage can.
"That is correct, sir. For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie."
Robbie's voice had a vaguely fey note that other movie robots were never able to duplicate. But his affectlessness was the model for the talking machines in dozens of movies and TV shows to follow, from Lost in Space to Doctor Who to The Jetsons to Star Trek. The pitch and tempo might vary, but the robot drone was always the same.
"Exterminate all humans!"
"I am
sorry, Will Robinson. I am afraid I goofed.
I am a machine, vastly superior to humans.
Shall we play a game?
Back to work. Back to work. Everybody. Work, 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 work. Work, work.
Program complete. Enter when ready.
I'll be back.
After a while, other movies started playing variations on that theme. In 2001, Stanley Kubrick modulated the traditional robot monotone into a preternaturally calm voice that suggested a paranoid's hyper-rationality. Hal talked the way Mr. Rogers would if he became a facilitator for a New Age cult.
I know that you and Frank were planning to disconnect me, and I'm afraid that's something I cannot allow to happen.
Then there was the lugubrious robot Marvin from the BBC version of Douglas Adams' Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. In his case, the low affect voice was a sign of chronic depression.
Sorry, did I say something wrong? Pardon me for breathing, which I never do anyway, so I don't know why I bother to say it. Oh, God, I'm so depressed.
The voices of other movie robots didn't suggest an absence of emotion so much as emotional immaturity. In the 1986 film Short Circuit, the robot Johnny Five speaks with the adenoidal Jerry Lewis voice that connotes the prototypical dweeb.
Need input. I have questions, queries.
But however they speak, movie robots and computers always convey their lack of humanity in familiarly human tones. That's what drama requires, of course, whether the machines are cast as villains, heroes, or sidekicks. But none of those movie machines prepared us for how deeply weird machines would actually sound when they acquired voices of their own. The early speech synthesis systems had otherworldly voices that were barely comprehensible.
For your convenience, I am honored to respond to the name Robbie.
Granted, speech engineers have made a lot of progress since then, particularly in rendering the timbre of the human voice. Here's a state-of-the-art synthesizer from AT&T.
For your convenience, I am monitored to respond to the name Robbie.
You can count on hearing a lot more voices like that in the future. If the engineers have their way, speech technology is going to go a long way to taking high-maintenance humans out of the customer service loop. But as good as they've gotten, computer voices are still patently unhuman. Whatever personality disorder they're suffering from, it isn't anything you'll find in DSM-3. There are two problems in getting robot voices right. The first is that their words don't mean anything to them. The second is that they don't know what their words mean to their listeners. They don't know what tone to take when they're telling you something. When you call to complain about your phone bill, you don't want the computer to tell you the bad news in an upbeat voice.
I'm sorry, you'll have to pay another installation fee.
Now, I'm sure that even as we speak, there's a team at AT&T or Carnegie Mellon working on the problem of computer abjection. But getting tone right isn't just a matter of synthesizing intelligence. Voice is the sound that the mind makes when it scrapes against the body. You can hear that in the awkward rhythms and transitions of machine speech, which suggest just how hard it is to mimic the moist ballistics of the human tongue. But it takes more than an artificial mouth to infuse a voice with warmth or sympathy or contrition. Emotion comes from lower down than that. You have to suggest the rest of the body, too. That ups the ante considerably. Artificial intelligence has always been a game of deception, but up to now it's been limited to creating the illusion that there's a working mind at the other end of the line. Now we may have to deal with machines that can sound as if they had chests and shoulders, too. Imagine trying to talk to a computer at the bank that sounds like a harried middle-aged service rep hunched over his terminal in the seventh hour of his shift. It's an unnerving prospect. You might yearn for a hand with a hammer to appear out of nowhere.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center and the author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. Coming up, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new Artie Shaw box set. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. Artie Shaw was one of the stars of the swing era and one of the esteemed jazz clarinetists from the late 1930s until he retired from music in 1954 to write fiction and his memoirs. He's now 91 years old. Shaw recently edited a 5-CD box set of his own music, drawing on commercial and private, studio and live recordings. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead likes it a lot, but says it also reveals much about the many contradictions behind Shaw's career.
That's Artie Shaw's theme song. For promotional reasons, every swing band leader had one, but it was typical Shaw to make his theme a downer called Nightmare. Artie Shaw is one of the most conflicted jazz heroes. By his own account, he hated the glittery distractions of show business, yet he still managed to marry Ava Gardner and Lana Turner. His bands didn't last either. He was always breaking one up only to dive into another, full of renewed hope. But in any setting, he was an excellent clarinet player, with daring ideas and a full sound in the high and low registers, a sound to beat rivals like Benny Goodman and Woody Herman. Artie Shaw's 1938 hit, Begin the Beguine. Shaw hated having hits, because people then expected him to play them. But the anti-commercial Shaw had a curious weakness for strings, which pop arrangers used to sweeten up music for the Rubes. Between 1936 and 53, Shaw augmented his bands with anywhere from 4 to 17 strings, looking for the right balance. He had some success as early as 1940. On Lenny Hayton's arrangement of Temptation, 9 strings prove loud and supple enough to stand beside the band's horn sections. Artie Shaw also led stringless swing bands, well represented among the 95 tracks he picked for his 5-CD self-portrait. It also includes a few live rarities and appearances by hip singers like Hot Lips Page and Billie Holiday. There are always better and harder swinging big bands, but some of the weird stuff with strings wears well, or at least exerts some grotesque fascination. Coming to it out of context, you might wonder if it's meant as serious or satire. That's from the fitfully entertaining Concerto for Clarinet of 1940. Bridging high and low culture and jumping between diverse styles from jazz to klezmer, Shaw anticipated John Zorn's postmodernism by half a century. Artie Shaw kept searching for an ideal setting. The irony was, he'd found it by 1940. Like Goodman and others, he started featuring a small band drawn from the ranks of the big one, the sextet Artie Shaw and his Gramercy Five. They had a pseudo-classical gimmick, too. Johnny Guarneri played harpsichord, which shouldn't have worked, but did. Gramercy 5 with Billy Butterfield on trumpet. In the next version, without harpsichord, the trumpeter was the great Roy Eldridge. Shaw was fondest of a later 1954 version, to judge by how much space he allots it in his self-portrait. It was his last working band before his premature retirement. Clarinet was the only horn this time, and Shaw sounded more reflective and at peace than ever. Producer Orrin Keepnew says Artie Shaw's self-portrait may be the first time an artist selected and annotated a personal best drawn from all available recordings. Whether that's true or not, it's an idea other producers should have the good sense to steal, even if other artists don't make as judicious a selection as Artie Shaw has.
Kevin Whitehead reviewed the new box set, Artie Shaw Self-Portrait. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharuk directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audi, presenting Audi-assured certified pre-owned cars, including the A4, A6, and A8 with quattro all-wheel drive. AudiUSA.com/pre-owned. And from Wilmington Trust, a wealth management company providing investment and trust services to individuals, families, and corporations nationwide for nearly 100 years. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, ethnic and political divisions in Afghanistan and how they may affect the next government. We talk with Larry Goodson, author of Afghanistan's Endless War. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.